Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.
Fueled by Frank and Honest Gourmet Coffee. The perfect blend to kickstart your day. Barista quality coffee available at Centra and Supervalue.
Just a little ears warning for our next guest. Trish Kearney was just 13 years old when she first encountered swimming coach George Gibney. He went on to sexually abuse her for years. He later avoided trial in Ireland on 27 counts of indecent assault and unlawful carnal knowledge of young Irish swimmers and lives freely in the USA. She joins me on the line now to tell me her story. Trish, you are very welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very good now, Jennifer. Thanks a million.
It's great to have you. Can we start with finding out about yourself before you ever encountered, you know, George Gibney? You grew up in Dublin, lovely family, and you adored swimming. Is that right?
Yeah, that's probably it in a nutshell. Absolutely happy out, living the life. And, you know, it was just a very carefree, happy life. I was probably a particularly contented child. But even in those early days, anyone that would know me would probably say I was kind of highly driven and very competitive. So when I eventually got into swimming, it really ticked all the boxes. You know, there was the training and there was the competing, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Oh, listen, you have to be a certain type of person, don't you? I mean, the training is full on. It's before school, it's after school. It's just one of those things you have to work so hard at. So that's just a testament to your character and what kind of person you are to do that. When did you first encounter George Gibney?
Well, I suppose, you know, when I fully encountered him, really, and he was a major figure in my life, was when I joined Trojan from another lesser competitive swimming club. I joined Trojan at 13. And really, it was very, very soon afterwards that Gibney kind of really impacted my life hugely. And bearing in mind that he'd already for 13 years been, that we now know, had been regularly abusing other children through the years. So realistically, I was just another one on his, you know, notch on his and his prey or whatever that he just wanted to control. And I was, as I say, just 13.
Trish, he was a powerful figure in Irish swimming. What were your first impressions of him?
Oh, I mean, as a child, I only saw him as a swimming coach, you know, and I thought, yeah, I want to be there. You know, the club were doing brilliantly. He gave great feedback. He was a meticulous coach, and that's exactly what I wanted. As a man, as a figure, I was a very very much a young child that, you know, lapped everything up. I wanted to be the best I could be, and I wanted to be you know, the attention on my stroke. I wanted everything. So Gibney provided all of that. You know, he was the boss. There was no other coaches. You know, I coached for many years, and, you know, you coached amongst groups of coaches. You moved from this coach to that coach. We didn't have that. You just had Gibney. He was the boss.
Can you talk?
I saw him as such.
Can you talk to me about what he did when you were just 13 by the pool?
Yeah, that was the first encounter, really, where I, in hindsight now as an adult, look back and I kind of mark that as the end of my before, really. You know, that was the first time that I kind of feel that, you know, it was, things were changing. But as a child, I didn't see it. And I was on the diving block in normal everyday training. Gibney did so much of what he did in plain sight. And so there was all other swimmers around. I happened to be the last person to go on the block. And instead of saying ready, go, and me, you know, to dive in and swim my length, he came over and I was sort of wondering why he wasn't coming over, why he wasn't saying ready, go. And as a young child, my immediate thing was, oh, did I get it wrong? Did I not go? Did, you know, was he coming out over to give out to me about something? And he came over and I would have been kind of smallish, and he's not a big man either. And so he was chest high and he was very close. And I was uncomfortable at that. And he said that he just looked at me and he said, I'm going to go to bed with you this weekend. And then as I'm kind of processing those words, he just about turned and said, ready, go. And I just dived in and swam the length trying to go, what? What did he just say? But with no understanding, you know, your seven-year-old would have known as much as I knew about what that meant.
Yeah.
And so realistically, as that child, I hadn't a clue what he meant. That's my first, you know, that's my ongoing memory of the first.
So
could have been more.
So confusion I suspect. I just picture you as a child under that water, swimming, and what was going through your head?
You know, I actually don't think it was that terrible, because if somebody said that to you, your seven-year-old would just go, oh, I don't know what that's all about, and swim on.
Yeah,
but that's what
true.
Happened to me. Until he actually, you know, began to actively abuse me, he could have said that every day of the week. It wouldn't have meant anything to me. As an adult, I know exactly what he meant, and I know exactly by the way he stood so close to me what was going on. But that child didn't know. And in fact, you know, I was a good, you know, 14 before I even understood what was going on. You know, I was complete innocent.
And from there started years of abuse.
Yeah. Me among many others, you know. I wasn't the only one at the time. Which I found out subsequently, there were others all at the same time. You know, people that I was swimming up and down with were equally being isolated and abused by him. But at the time, I thought it was only me and my world. And yeah, it was pretty relentless.
You just mentioned there the before. I presume you're talking about the before Trish, that little girl, and the after Trish.
Yeah.
How did it change your personality?
I think in two ways. You know, I think externally it changed me from an outgoing, very happy, relaxed, chatty, friendly child into a very introverted, wary individual who was very controlled by him. Even recently, a friend said that she always saw me as that outgoing child, you know, and I was that around her. But then I reminded her, do you not remember at galas that I sat with him? I wasn't talking to anyone. And, you know, so it was a very different person when I was around him. But I was in some ways lucky enough to be able to pretend that I was still, everything was okay when I was away from him. I kind of kept that girl alive to a degree. So I wasn't always, you know, alone and lonely when I was with other people, but I was extremely alone and lonely within the pool and galas and you know, even throughout life, you know, where you'd be rushing to school or that, sure, he'd be, you know, following me, and you know, so there was huge everyday impact on my life, and that girl was really struggling.
Talk to me about Ireland at the time and why this wasn't spoken about.
I think sometimes that does puzzle me hugely. You know, I can see that in two ways. I can see it from even my parents' point of view and my friends, and that people weren't looking out for this, because sexual abuse, there had been no big revelations at the time. That's probably why we were so unlucky. We were ahead of our time. We, you know, we were one of the first to come forward and bring this out in the open and say, this is what's happened to us and this is what abuse is. But no one was looking out for it because it wasn't spoken about. It wasn't talked about. People couldn't even imagine it. But what does sometimes puzzle me is that, you know, in hindsight, you know, when Gary did flag it and did warn people, that it wasn't at that point taken in. And you can see it even in the ongoing discussions now we're having about all the boys in that were abused, you know, by the Jesuit order.
Yeah,
it was just, you could see that, it, you know, it was there. But the people were just brushing it on and going to, you know, move that on now to the next place, and we'll be okay here, and we'll all forget about it. The boys will be grand, and you know, there was an element of that, you know, don't rock the boat. I think within society now, within the club and within our situation, I think it was compounded by the fact that Gibney was a very powerful, well-known man. I think that did have an impact on what happened.
We're understanding more and more these days about coercive control, and this is what he was doing to you, wasn't he?
Yes. Mm. And you know, I've often spoken to my own friends about the things, and they were saying that it wasn't actually until they read it in my book that they actually really got into the head of me as a child and how you could be so controlled. And, you know, it is so hard to understand how somebody can't just say, you know, to their mother who adores them, their dad, their brothers and sisters, their best friends, how someone can't just say, help me, but they can't. And it's exactly the same with adults. It's such
Absolutely.
A difficult thing to
Absolutely.
Say.
Absolutely. And we're talking about that more and more. And how I think we're all becoming a little bit more sympathetic to the fact that these people can't, because they're under a spell, they're under control. And we're learning about that more and more now, thank God. But at 18, you hit back big time. Tell me what happened when he picked you up at the bus stop.
Yeah, I was waiting at the bus stop, and he came by in his car, and I was standing at the back of all the people, and he opened up his car door and he's saying, "Trish, get in," you know. And again, maybe it's an Irish thing, maybe it's just a victim thing, but I didn't want to make a big fuss at the bus stop. And so anyway, I got into the car, and it had been a while since I had been abused really at that stage, but he was stalking me. And I had for a period of at least 12 months, I had feared that, you know, he was getting a little bit unhinged, you know, that it was I suppose I was becoming more an adult, and I was beginning to realize, you know, this could end very badly. You know, he could just lose it here and kill me. But anyway, for whatever reason, I got in the car, and I was sitting there, and there was no conversation, and I was terrified, and way more terrified than when I was a young child, because now I was an adult and I feared what he was going to do. And anyway, we continued to drive, and I said, "Look, I have to get home." And sure, we drove on, and we drove up the mountains, and he eventually parked. And on the way up, you know, I had just berated myself the whole way up for being just so stupid for getting in the car, because nobody in my life knew what I was going through. So nobody in my life would know who had done this to me if he did kill me. You know, I just had that just massive fear. And then he turned in a car park. He turned to me, and he was saying, "I just want to talk to you." And he undid his safety belt, and then he locked the doors. And when he locked the doors, I think that just, you know, triggered something within me. And, you know, while I had spent the whole way up thinking I was going to be killed, whatever adrenaline rush I got, I was having none of it. And I lashed out and fought back. And I often say, if I had a weapon that day, I don't know what would have happened to him. But I you know, he backed off, and I don't really recall what happened after that in terms of me getting home. But that was the last incident with him. And he did stalk me a little bit after that, but nothing like it was.
Did you tell anyone at this stage what was going on, or,
no,
you know, consider going to the guards? No.
Oh, no. No, no. I was still 13, 14, 15. You know, this was a very separate, bubbled off part of my life that I thought I was hemmed in, and there was no way I was going to tell anyone. And, you know, as I got older, there is an inbuilt shame and guilt, not for anything you're doing, but just so much that you're kind of, you know, at that stage, this isn't right. And you're putting it back on yourself hugely, you know, for no reason. But it is a part of you, because a part of you knows, now this is after getting a bit mad. This man is a married man, you know, and I'm grown up. What's happening here? So from that point of view, I think that compounded the secret.
You did a really good job of hiding what was going on, but the birth of your first child changed that.
Yes, yeah. I think, you know, I think there may be a few reasons, but possibly, you know, the whole birthing process and your vulnerability and all of that. I think that maybe, you know, let out some demons, I'm not sure, but I definitely didn't feel, you know, the best after it in that first year. And when I began to look back through it, you know, I was having flashbacks, which I hadn't had up until she was born. And this was only, you know, I was only 26 at this stage, so I wasn't that old. And that first year of her life, I was, you know, getting these flashbacks, and they were short enough that I could just keep batting them away, until then Gary sent a letter in 1990, the end of that year, when she was a year old. And that kind of, you know, I couldn't hide then. It, you know, the secret was out at that stage. I wasn't the only one. And kind of my bubble of my past was well and truly burst.
He was exposed as a sex offender in 94. It was out. How did you feel?
It was very difficult, because at that stage we had been 2 years going through the law court.
Okay.
And we're sure that, you know, we had given our statements, we had, you know, I had learned that there were other people, and it was just extremely sad and shocking to realize that, you know, what I had gone through, so had so many others, and they were even younger than me. Like Burke Carley, who speaks so beautifully on the podcast, she was only 9. You know, there was Chalky, there was Lorraine, there was so many people. There was, you know, the pseudonym Susan on the podcast is people that speak up and tell their story, and you can see every single person was so badly hurt. And so then when it came to 94 and we were told, no, actually, there's no court case, those people were badly hurt. Like, we were all hurt. Whether there's a court case or not, you know, we all went through this pain, and now we're being told, yeah, no, he's actually, there's nothing we can do. And so then Johnny Waterson rode in on his white horse, and Peter Murtaghan, they put it in the Sunday Tribune. And, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here chatting to you today if they hadn't done that, because we wouldn't have been allowed to talk about George Gibney as a sex offender. He would have completely got away with it. And so, like, while it was extremely difficult at that stage because so many people said that we were telling lies, you know, what they did at that time has allowed us escape Gibney, really.
Speaking of escapism, he escaped justice and is now living in Florida. I mean, how does that make you feel?
You know, I feel from the point of view of Gibney, of me with Gibney, I'm quite happy that he's very far away from my world and I'll never see him again. I think the fact that the Where's George Gibney podcast has been downloaded by so many million people, I don't know, does he live the most easy, relaxed life now? You know, surely he's looking over his shoulders as if the wolves of the past are coming back to you know, feed off him, because you know, that's what is happening. People do know that this man did this, and they do know where he is. And you, like, while he is over there, I don't necessarily ever think that George Gibney lives a life absolutely free. He's lost his family. He's lost, you know, everything. You know, whether it's enough to pay for what he did to us, of course it's not. But whether it's enough for me, it is. But the new people that have come forward, 18 further cases have come forward, you know, I think every single person deserves whatever justice they feel is necessary for them to heal.
Speaking of healing, can we talk about your life now?
Yeah, my life now is excellent, really, I have to say. You know, I'm married, I have children.
You have 5 children.
I'm living here with a mother to 5, and I love my life. I'm very, very happy. But, you know, it's been hard won. And I just think it's you know, it's very, very important that I'd like even to let people see that, yes, I have come through, and I'm very, very lucky to have come through. But, you know, whatever you can get to at the end that makes you feel better is good. Like, it's not a competition for every single person to be as well and as happy and content in life as me. I think everybody just has to do their best. And while there are people that are really struggling, and even people that you know, were abused by Gibney, continue to find life very difficult, I think it's good to be able to look to somebody somewhere and say, you know, well, look, there's hope there. Everybody, you know, everybody needs somebody that they can just look to and say, you know, maybe if I don't get to that, I might even get partway there, that there's a level of happiness that can be achieved, or peace even. You know, and I think it's very different for everybody. And I feel very lucky that I have attained, you know, the level of contentedness in life I have. And I just feel that, you know, it would be nice for people to be able to look at somebody. You know, that old saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it. Mm. So, you know, just for anyone that's struggling today, that, you know, my father, before he died, had this massive image in his head. He died of motor neurone disease, and he gave it to us, and he just said, keep the fire within you burning, you know, never let that candle go out. And some days that candle might be very, very dim, but always keep it lit. And I think that's, you know, don't live in darkness, just light the candle and have hope.
Your message is so important. And I mean, you're not just victims, you know, you're a mother, you're a nurse, you're showing and telling people who may be struggling or victims of sexual abuse that it is capable to have a happy, normal life. I mean, that is very doable. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and speaking so well about your story and being so honest. And then your book, Above Water, why was that therapeutic in writing in itself? Is that why you did it? Was it to, was there any other messages in there? Why did you feel a need to put pen to paper?
I suppose I really put pen to paper, if I'm being completely honest, because, well, one, I just love writing, and but I really wanted a document for my children, because it's not something I'd ever talk about, and with them, not that I mind talking about it, but it's just not in our everyday life. But a part of me wanted them to know that, you know, this is within your DNA. You know, this is what your mum went through, and you know, this is part of your life too. But then when the book was written, during the writing of it, the podcast came about, and so many people became very, very interested in the story. A lot of young people became interested in the story. And so they then, you know, became interested in my story as a result, because of the fact that I went on the podcast. And so that, you know, it's nearly been a twofold thing. I have it written now for my children, and they are very proud, and my family are very proud. But also it has this knock-on side effect of you know, people who've never been through abuse can read and see, oh, okay, and they get a better understanding of what their relative has gone through. Not the details. There's no details. There's no disasters. You know, there's no horror in that sense in the book. But there is the understanding of what happened. And also then for others who have been through it, you know, that they can sort of say, yeah, me too. You know, that happened to me. That's exactly what happened with me. And, you know, that they can sort of be proud of themselves like I am for you know, for surviving what they went through. Like, there's a very different thing between feeling brave and being brave. And sometimes people after abuse don't feel that they were brave, but that doesn't mean they weren't. They were very brave. And, you know, hopefully their book will show them how brave they were. My book will show them how brave they were and help them, you know, overcome it that way.
It is a powerful read, and we can only thank you for sharing your story. And I'm sure you've helped so many people just by talking to us today. Trish Kearney, thank you so much for joining me on the show. And Above Water is out now. I wish you and your family the very best of luck, and the best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much. And thanks for
Trish.
Having me on.
Bye, Trish. Bye. Bye-bye. Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.